It seems unimaginable today that an important urban development project like Central Park could be headed by an architect with no previous design experience. However, that was the case in the mid-19th century when Frederick Law Olmsted began the project. He'd been a sailor, a journalist, a farmer before he went on to become one of the most important landscape architects in world history. Justin Martin chronicles his life in his latest book, The Genius of Place, The Life of Frederick Law Olmsted. It's published by DeCapo Press, and I'm very pleased it has brought Mr. Martin to our show today. Hello.
Hello.
You say Olmsted was a man of his generation. What characterizes the generation that came of age in the 1840s?
What especially characterizes them is a little bit like the 1940s, the people who were involved in World War II, they were often called the greatest generation. Well, Olmsted's generation, people who came of age in the 1840s, were very committed to social reform in all different areas.
He was born in the midst of the Second Great Awakening.
That's correct. Uh-huh.
What role did that play in shaping his thinking?
Again, I guess it sort of made people sort of outward looking. It made them very intent on wanting to change the country. And so he certainly, in his particular case, he didn't have a religious awakening, but he certainly had a kind of a moral awakening. He wanted to be involved in various capacities.
He became an abolitionist later.
Mm-hmm.
Had he been exposed to architecture? Did his parents have an interest in design?
No, his parents had just an incredible interest in nature, and they used to take these horseback rides that were just completely silent. They would just ride. He and his brother, his mother and his stepmother, rather, and his father would ride on horseback completely silent, just appreciating the wonder and the beauty of nature. However, architecture he wasn't exposed to, at least through his family.
You say his stepmother because his mother died of an overdose of opiates.
That's right. Yeah, that was one of the sort of the very formative, shocking events for him, I think, at about the age of three. His mother took an overdose of opiates, and he walked into the room as his father had discovered this, and he was ushered out, and he sensed that there was this, you know, tumultuous event. And of course, his mother was then gone, and it really shaped him.
What kind of education did he have?
He had a very piecemeal education. His stepmother felt that he should go away for his schooling, and he entered a whole series of country parsonages where the parsons, as one of their duties, educated kids. So he'd go from one to another. He was often a disciplinary problem. He wasn't very focused. And ultimately, he left school at a pretty young age, 14. He briefly returned to Yale in his late teens as a kind of visiting student, but it didn't really take. He was there for all of 3 months.
And took to the sea.
And exactly. He tried many different things early in his life, and one of the things that he tried out was being a sailor, and he took a voyage to China. One thing that it certainly had the effect of was he was forced to focus on something. And early in his life, he was very kind of scattered, but he only had two choices. He could either make the voyage to China or back, or at some point he could jump ship. He did choose to make the voyage to China and back, and as a consequence, it sort of gave him some discipline.
Well, landscaping is very common in Asia, Japan, and China, but I get the feeling that had little impact on him.
That didn't really affect him.
Was it England where he really started thinking about this?
Very much more England, yes. As a farmer, he had the opportunity to take a walking tour with his brother across England, and he saw English parks. He also saw the grounds of castles, and that really started to give him some ideas.
So he became a farmer. Did he study agriculture?
He did. He studied agriculture from the standpoint that he was, unlike so many farmers of his day, he was literate, so he read a lot of agricultural journals and sort of gleaned various best practices. And one of his earliest ideas for how he could act as a kind of reformer was he would read agricultural journals, he would glean various agricultural innovations, and he would try to disseminate that information to his fellow farmers, many of whom were illiterate.
But his first farm was a failure.
Yes, it was. His first farm was just an abject failure, and he complained to his father. He claimed that it was actually a farm that he'd picked out, but he started maintaining. It was a seaside farm in Connecticut, exactly what he'd wanted. But he started complaining and claiming that there were certain attributes of it that weren't to his taste and hadn't worked out right. And so his father, who was a very indulgent man, bought him a second farm in Staten Island. And there he actually found his way a bit as a farmer.
And that was his first experience with landscape architecture? I usually don't associate farming with landscape architecture. Should I?
Yeah, not really. I guess in Olmsted's case, he started to get interested in a kind of casual, sort of amateur way with just doing things like moving a barn so that you'd have a better view of Raritan Bay off Staten Island, having a curving road head up to your farmhouse and so forth. And, of course, Staten Island in that era had a lot of Dutch settlers, many of whom were quite well-off gentlemen farmers. And so some of them, including some of the Vanderbilts, started to hire Olmsted. Those were his very first landscaping jobs, just to kind of redesign their farms to create a nice winding road up to their farmhouse or what have you.
What led him to become an abolitionist? In the 40s or so, abolitionists weren't even popular in the North. That all changed in the lead up to the Civil War. But he was pretty early in his opposition to slavery.
He was.
Had he gone to the South? Had he seen it in action?
He sure had. What happened was he got a job with the very first, very early in the life of the New York Times, about 1852, Olmsted got a job, and his incredible assignment with the New York Times was to travel through the American South and report extensively on slavery. He had a five-minute interview to land this gig, but one of the things he established in the five-minute interview was that he would be open-minded. He wasn't going to approach the South either as a slavery sympathizer, nor is he going to approach it as an abolitionist. Once he traveled through the South, he was on the ground reporting, talking to slaves, talking to plantation owners, and he saw the conditions of slavery firsthand, and he was convinced that slavery was evil, and he created a series of really powerful dispatches because instead of coming at the South with preconceived notions, he was actually reporting on the ground, and people got to watch him make the transition from open-minded to ultimately concluded, based on his reporting, that slavery was an evil institution.
But New York was one of the northern cities that was most in sympathy with the South.
Mm-hmm.
So what was the reaction to his articles in the New York Times?
Well, the articles were actually – they were very well received because people – I think people bought his arguments and they saw this was vigorous reporting. They saw here was a man who'd actually spoken to slaves, spoken to plantation owners. He also went at it as a farmer. So he had some idea of from his background as a farmer, he had some idea about agricultural conditions, and he could see that in the South that slavery was a terribly – not only a cruel system, but also a terribly economically inefficient system. And so he, I think his reporting was considered, whether people agreed with it or not, it was considered, you know, rigorous reporting that people appreciated.
Now, previous books by you were about Ralph Nader and Alan Greenspan. They don't prepare me for thinking about you as the author of a biography of Frederick Law Olmsted.
Well, I'll tell you what the connection is. The connection is all three of my subjects have been people who are just really kind of generalists, people with varied experience. In the case of Greenspan, long before he became Fed chairman, he was a professional jazz musician. Then he was part of Ayn Rand's inner circle and was actually involved in the research and the work on her work, Atlas Shrugged. So you've got Greenspan as a kind of generalist figure before he became Fed chairman. In Ralph Nader's case, you've got a lawyer, journalist, consumer advocate, and very memorably a presidential candidate. And Olmsted, I felt he was sort of the ultimate, varied person, really a true Renaissance man, an American Renaissance man, and that was why I was drawn to him as a subject.
And Frederick Law Olmsted is the subject of Genius of Place, Justin Martin's latest biography. It is published by, who's publishing this? DiCapo. And we will continue our conversation. We'll find out about what happened, how Central Park came to be right after we take a little break. Stay with us. We're back with Justin Martin, whose book, Genius of Place, The Life of Frederick Law Olmsted, is published by DiCapo. So we've been talking about a life that doesn't really lead us to think about Central Park. What led Olmsted – well, when did the idea for creating a park in the middle of Manhattan come from?
The idea of creating a park goes all the way back to the 1700s, and for years there had been talk about we need a park, let's have a park. Very notable people like William Cullen Bryant, the editor of The Post, had called for a park.
And because there were so few open spaces in New York, I gather people would go to cemeteries to get away from all the noise.
Yeah, Greenwood Cemetery. People love to go out to Greenwood Cemetery and picnic in the shadow of a mausoleum. So yeah, New York City was you know, it was growing quickly, but it was also whatever little squares and so forth were being swallowed up. And there was a sense that unless wise minds prevailed quickly, that the city would be filled in. And unless people set aside a big swath of land to be a park, the city would just fill in with development.
Had the grid system already been put into place?
It had been. It was put in place in 1811 and all the way up through, I think, 155th Street. So they'd already planned a very rigorous angular grid all the way uptown.
And so they decided just to take a rectangle from the center of it and make it into a park?
They did, for a couple of really good reasons. First of all, for anybody who's ever visited Central Park, you'll see that there are these kind of bursts of rock that come up out of the ground. And that's called Manhattan mica schist. It's really tough rock. It's lower down, further down in the city, in the 30s or 40s. It's further beneath the ground so that you can have it actually act as the foundations for some of the skyscrapers. But this piece of land that they set aside for Central Park, the mica schist was very close to the surface. So it's a very unattractive piece of land. The other reason they decided to create it where they did was they thought if they created a long rectangular park, all the properties on the periphery would be very attractive properties and they'd pay a lot in taxes.
But people were living in this area, mostly poor people, minorities. And I would think that Olmsted, who was an abolitionist, might feel a little uncomfortable seeing them thrown off of their land.
I guess a lot of them, he doesn't seem to have felt too uncomfortable about it. His job was actually to clear the land. The people had already been driven off the land. Many of them had no title to it. A lot of them were sort of penny ante farmers who were running chicken farms and hog farms and the like. They were sort of outside of city limits. And they didn't have title to the land. And so a series of marshals, including Joe Pepitone, the Yankee great's great-great-great-grandfather, was one of the marshals who actually cleared the people off the land.
So his original role was in helping to clear the land?
Yeah, it was the
Olmsted's, I mean.
Olmsted's was, yes. The Panic of 1857, which was just a terrible economic event, Olmsted lost his journalism job. That's what he'd been doing at that point. And so he was forced to take a job that was not one he was ideally suited for, but it was certainly he needed work and he owed a lot of people money. And the job that he took was called superintendent for the new Central Park. It hadn't been built or designed yet. And his job was basically to knock down shanties and drain swamps and clear this piece of land to prepare it for a future design.
Which he would play no role in.
He was not to play any. When he took the job, his notion was he would just be – his qualification really was that he'd been a farmer. And he knew how to work with crews of men doing things like clearing land, and that was really what he was going to bring to it.
So were there a number of people up for the job?
What happened was there was a public design competition announced. You mean for the superintendent mm-hmm. job?
No. I meant once it was decided the land had been cleared, I'm informed most of the people being illegal Irish immigrants who were also discriminated against in those days. So they were cleared. And Calvin Vaux already had the job, or did he have to enter some kind of competition?
What happened was they announced, the Central Park Board announced that once Olmsted cleared the land, they announced a competition for a new design for Central Park. And 33 people came up with designs. One of the people was Calvert Vaux, who was a trained architect, and he sought out Olmsted. And the reason he wanted to work with Olmsted was because Olmsted had been out on this piece of land, you know, knocking down shanties and so forth. And Vaux thought, oh, if we team up together for the design competition, I'll have the advantage of this guy Olmsted, who knows the lay of the land quite literally. What Calvert Vaux hadn't counted on was Olmsted was also as this kind of Renaissance man was going to bring all of these amazing ideas. And so, as I said, there were 33 contestants. They just trounced the competition. Their design was instantly recognized as the winning design.
How much did the city budget for the creation of Central Park?
All of the 33 designs were supposed to be done within $1.5 million. And, you know, in typical fashion, as you might imagine, most of the contestants, they came up with whatever plan they came up with, and they had a little appendage at the bottom of their plan where they said, I can do this within $1.5 million. Pretty much that's what Olmsted and Vaux did. They came in at about $8 million. So they definitely
– A lot more.
Yeah.
Because it would have been impossible for any of them to have created a park that was anything less than just a bunch of fields.
Definitely. Definitely. Very, very early on in the process, they'd already busted their $1.5 million budget and had to keep coming back again and again to get further appropriations.
Well, there were certain guidelines with regard to what the park had to include, which would have cost a lot more than $1.5 million. Anyway, what were some of them?
Some of them were the park had to have – it had to have a parade ground. It had to have certain fountains. It had to have a grand promenade. And then the most important thing, and this is where Calvert Vaux and Olmsted just trounced the competition, was there had to be 4 crossing points in the park. The idea was as Manhattan developed, you certainly didn't want to have this rectangle that people had to get around. That would be impossible. They had to be able to cross the park. The other 32 contestants all just basically drew a road at 4 different spots crossing the park. And, of course, that carved the park into pieces. Olmsted and Vaux had this brilliant just – masterstroke, which was called sunken transverses. They'd have sunken roads that would cross the park at those 4 places. That meant that the traffic would travel below ground level, so people wouldn't have to see a cart rolling by or what have you. It also meant you could build land bridges over the transverses, and so people could walk from the southern to the northern tip of the park as long as they crossed those land bridges without ever having to, in that era at least, cross any kind of traffic.
But that's not what happened.
It was designed that way, and of course, in a later day to accommodate the automobile in particular. There are places in Central Park now where sadly you do have to encounter cars, but there are also places where you can be crossing and actually have taxis passing beneath you, buses, and not even notice it. So their plan is still partway in force.
How long did it take to complete the park?
It took one way of describing it is Central Park was never really completed because it's continued all the way to this point to be altered to suit new taste and so forth. But kind of officially, it was finished about 1868. It took about 10 years to complete.
So it was being worked on during the Civil War.
It was actually worked on really, unlike a lot of things, work on it continued intensely during the Civil War. It was a huge public works project. It employed a lot of people. So it kept going through the Civil War.
And how was it viewed by New Yorkers at the time? Did it appeal to people of all classes?
It did. It actually – one of the great things was that the Central Park Board very wisely – They said people have been waiting all these years to have this park open. Let's not just have people wait until it's complete and have it debuted. Let's open it in stages. And the very first thing that was open was the pond, or the lake rather, for ice skating in the winter of 1858, the very first season of construction on the park. The first weekend, a winter in December, on a Saturday, 300 people showed up to ice skate. The next Saturday, 10,000 people showed up. On subsequent Saturdays, many more than 10,000 even showed up. And according to a lot of contemporaneous newspaper accounts that I read, you had that's one of the things that the newspapers noted was out on the ice, you had everything from ladies of Fifth Avenue, as they described it, to urchins from the avenues further towards the river, as the newspaper accounts of that era described it.
And to some degree, that's still the case with the park.
Very, very much.
It's a very democratic park.
It remains a very – per Olmsted's – Olmsted and Vaux's original intention, it remains a place where people really mix and mingle.
Well, so does Prospect Park, which they also worked on. Was that just their theory of park?
It was very much their theory of parks. They wanted to per this sort of coming of age in the 1840s desire to create social reform. They wanted to create parks that – mixed people for democratic purposes. They also had a kind of 19th century sense of noblesse oblige. So they wanted to elevate people, recent immigrants to this country and so forth, by having a park that would kind of expose them to fine and artful things.
My guest is Justin Martin. His latest biography is called Genius of Place, The Life of Frederick Law Olmsted. His personal life went through changes at this time, didn't it?
It did. No, Olmsted, you can't find a period in his life when there isn't terrible tumult. Almost every single park project he worked on, at some point along the line, there was some kind of personal issue or tragedy. In the case of Central Park, he got into a carriage accident, and his young son, was an infant son named John Theodore, was killed So Olmsted always...
Well, he also married his brother's widow, didn't he?
That is correct, yes. Another thing which happened about the time that he became superintendent, the job where he was clearing the park, he received a deathbed letter from his brother who was dying of tuberculosis. It had a P.S. that literally said, the very last words of his brother to Olmsted was, "Don't let Mary suffer while you're alive." And Mary was his brother's widow, and Olmsted took that quite literally and married his brother's widow.
Well, here he is working on this major project at the same time he got involved with the Civil War.
That's right. Yeah, Olmsted actually left. The Central Park was kind of on an even keel. It was sort of he'd done what he wanted to do, and the construction was off and running when in 1861 the Civil War broke out. He certainly wanted to be involved. By this time, he was about 40 years old. He'd also – that carriage accident he'd had seriously damaged his leg. He was certainly not fit to be a soldier, but he still managed to find a role. He managed to become the head of a medical unit that just provided incredible, untold aid to wounded soldiers at Antietam and Gettysburg and other major conflicts during the Civil War.
So he's been a sailor. He has been a farmer. Mm-hmm. He has built Central Park, and he also gets involved in the medical side of the war. Mm-hmm. But then after a significant break, Olmsted and Vaux also started working on Prospect Park, a very different kind of park.
Very different kind of park. Prospect Park was sort of a ready-made park from the standpoint that unlike Central Park, which was this really ugly piece of land that had to be really engineered into something that was natural-looking, beautiful, Prospect Park was just a beautiful piece of land. And in a way, Olmsted and Vaux's job was easier from the standpoint that they were required to create various structures, arches and bridges. The other thing that was interesting that Olmsted did was when he saw a really striking example of an old-growth tree, he for Prospect Park, he had a new innovation. He had a tree-moving machine, and it would just pluck these trees up, almost like plucking up a dandelion, a giant old-growth tree. And he would look around Prospect Park. He'd say, "Boy, that is a beautiful oak, but boy, it would look nice about 100 yards down the lot, down the way." And so he'd move the trees. So Prospect Park involved having a strikingly beautiful piece of land and kind of moving it around.
Although Central Park seems to be almost totally manufactured, Prospect Park looks like it was a wild land that was tamed. Did he just continue working as a landscape architect after this? Did his partnership with Calvin Vaux continue happily?
He continued at the same time that he was working at Prospect Park, he had an opportunity to become the editor and co-founder of The Nation magazine. And so he was doing both things at the same time.
So he's very political as well.
He's very political. And so he was involved in the founding of The Nation, which, of course, is still with us.
Well, he was nominated to be vice president at one point.
He was nominated to be vice president at one point. So he had various sidelines, although over time – the demand on him to be a landscape architect became so intense that any sideline he might have considered, such as The Nation, which he eventually moved away from because he just didn't have time, he became more and more of a pure landscape architect just because that's where the demand was. Per your other question, though, his partnership with Vaux broke up at a certain point. It was always a stress-filled, contentious partnership. Ultimately, he and Vaux broke up. And one way to describe it is Olmsted continued to kind of skyrocket. Vaux went almost straight down, sadly.
Now, what party nominated him, or was he possibly nominated for vice president?
He was nominated for vice president from a splinter, you might almost call it a fourth party. It was people who didn't want to be – they didn't like Ulysses S. Grant. They didn't like Ulysses S. Grant's alternative, who I believe was Horace Greeley. So they formed a yet different splinter party that wasn't taken very seriously.
Now, he also worked on parks all over, and not just parks, but in Chicago, Niagara Falls, on the Capitol grounds, Montreal, Boston. Did he – view Central Park as his most important achievement, as many New Yorkers probably would?
He definitely viewed it. It was his first work. It was hailed as a masterpiece, and he had a kind of a sense of eternal vigilance about it because, of course, there were opportunities throughout the rest of his life for people to roll it back. For instance, the notorious Tweed Ring, they had all kinds of ideas of how to mess up the park. So Olmsted would write editorials in the New York Times saying, you know, let's not mess this up. So he always clung to Central Park as his masterpiece, but he continued also to, you know, throw himself whole cloth, whole energy into these other projects, and it made him a very busy, stressed out, hard-driven man.
We have about 20 seconds left, but what is his legacy? Would we say the High Line is a direct descendant of his thinking or other parks around the world?
Sure. You could just say that the idea that a city isn't complete unless it has some green space, something to act as a counterbalance to the city itself, is very much his legacy, and you see it, whether it's in his own parks or parks that are inspired by him all over the country.
And his sons wound up getting into landscape architecture as well.
They did. That's right.
And were they successful?
They not only were they successful, they took the practice he'd started all the way up to 1958. So,
Genius of Place, The Life of Frederick Law Olmsted is Justin Martin's latest book. It is published by DeCapo. Thank you so much for being
with us. My pleasure. Thank you so much.